Hello. 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 Hello.
Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone. Have you had it with the Aaron Water Show? Are your ears recovered? Well, I hope so, because now you can sit back and relax and listen to a couple hours of talk. We're going to be talking legal stuff at the 8 o'clock hour. Any legal questions you have, as usual, we'll be taking your calls. But in the first hour, we've got a couple good guests. About 7:30, we're talking to Damien Mason, one of the best public speakers in the nation. He's been a friend of mine for a million years. He's going to talk about success, not just in business, but in your personal life. How do you define success, and how do you go about achieving it? And it sounds, it might sound like it's not specific, but he's going to have some very specific tips for all of us and how to be happy and successful at the same time. But first, we're going to talk about a very interesting play that's going on in Chicago. Agatha Christie, this play, And Then There Were None, it's the world's best-selling mystery and actually the sixth best-selling novel of all time. It was published in 1939. It's been performed on stage over hundreds of thousands of times and was made into at least 9 movie productions. A play is being performed at the Drury Lane Theater in Oakbrook, and joining us to talk about the play and the theater scene is the play's director, Jessica Fish, and Larry Baker, the production stage manager, and my high school classmate. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Karen.
So let's talk a little bit about Agatha Christie's book, And Then There Were None, and about the title. The title has an interesting kind of tortured history, and I don't want to dwell on it too much, but Jessica, tell our listeners what Agatha Christie's, how it evolved from the book to the play and the titles.
Sure. The book was actually published in 1939 in Great Britain under a title that actually references a nursery rhyme that she used to frame the whole play. That title includes a racist term that was part of the original poem. When she brought it to America, she changed that title to a new title, which features another sort of off-color title. So the play has this history of two sort of insensitive titles carried with it. And since, you know, the play was never produced in the United States under that title, but it's been performed ever since as And Then There Were None.
And let's, Ben, we have a little clip from the play. And in the play, Larry, I'm going to ask you briefly what the plot is, but I'm going to play a little bit of the characters who are reciting a portion of the play that we're talking about. Go ahead, Ben.
Oh, there's the old nursery rhyme. They're the 10 little soldier boys from the nursery rhyme, I suppose. 10 little soldier boys going out to dine. One choked his little self, and then there were 9.
9 little soldier boys sat up very late. One overslept himself, and then there were 8.
8 little soldier boys traveling in Devon. One got left behind, and then there were 7.
Okay, so this is the nursery rhyme upon which the book and then the play are based. And Larry, can you give our audience, without, of course, this is a mystery, so you're not going to obviously give
away
spoiler the whodunit. No, we're not going to do that. You have to come see it. But what is the general gist of the play?
I would say that 10 strangers are invited to an island mansion off the coast of Devon by a mysterious host by the name of U.N. Owen. And once the guests have all arrived, a recording begins to play, and the voice of the unseen host accuses each of them of a crime for which they must pay. And from there on, murder, mystery, and mayhem ensue.
So, you know, this play has been performed over, I mean, it has to be tens of thousands, if not 100,000 times over the last, I don't know, 76 years and three movies. How do you go about directing, Jessica, a play like this that has been performed so many times? So my question is, do you kind of see as many of the renditions as you can and then extrapolate and take what you like, or do you give it your own fresh view?
Well, I mean, I was an Agatha Christie fan before I was anything, so I had a great deal of affection for her writing, and I also love puzzles, and so to me, I guess the way that we approached making the play was we wanted to make a sort of amazing puzzle for the audience to kind of experience and try to solve along with us. So, you know, I kind of immersed myself in that world of her novels before going into rehearsal for the play, and read a lot about her life because she's had a super interesting life. And I also take a lot of inspiration from the fact that she was a, you know, a woman novelist. She was the breadwinner in her family, and I that's very inspiring to me. And I really wanted to make a version of this play for 2019 that really elevated the women in the story and really made the heroine the central, the pinnacle of the story. And I think we achieved that with some really interesting sort of focusing in of the story and some new changes and tweaks.
You know, I read that book a long time ago. My mother was a big Agatha Christie fan, so I read it when I was very young. And then just strangely, about 6 or 8 months ago, I reread it, and I did not remember who did it.
It holds up.
But it does hold up, yeah. And I was equally surprised, and maybe that's just my fading memory, but I was surprised at the whodunit. Do people guess? Because they're really, it's a hard one to guess.
I mean, no, and no, and what's amazing, too, we have to remember is that we take for granted this convention of, like, strangers trapped in a house, strangers trapped in an island, but Agatha Christie invented that with this book. She was the first one to set up. It seems, oh, it's cliche. It's only cliche because Agatha Christie wrote it.
Yes.
So, no, I think that it's shocking to me. I think we get amazing gasps in the audience. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of reveals. There's a lot of blood in the play. So
oh, blood.
We have a very mm-hmm. vocal audience reaction.
So you put blood in the play. That's kind of a new twist to the plays and the, yeah. and the movies, right?
Yeah.
And why did you do that?
I mean, it's 2019. We want the gore, right, Larry?
That's right.
Sagecraft.
That's right. Give them something shocking. And I think it's interesting, too, because people that I've talked to that do know the book or do know the play and have seen it before, it's also a great adventure for them to watch it, because then you're watching it at a very different eye, and you can actually see all the murders happen if you really look.
Mm-hmm.
But Jessica's magic is that we use the old magician term of misdirection, because we're going to make you look stage right while something happens stage left that you're not supposed to see.
I always say, like, I dare the real Agatha Christie fans in the audience to watch, because I think we do a pretty good job of even if you know what's happening, it's hard to catch it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to give away a gift certificate for 2 tickets to the Drury Lane Theater in Oak Brook, and they're good for this play. We're going to close pretty soon, but of any other play. So I'm going to take the third caller at 312-981-7200 who can answer this trivia question. Who's got the trivia question? The Agatha Christie trivia question.
Sure. So Agatha Christie's husband, her first husband, was cheating on her, and she staged her own disappearance. The question is,
in real life,
God love her. In how many days did Agatha Christie go missing before she was found?
How many days did she go missing before she was found? Third caller with the right answer, 312-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show.
I love her, but she loves Agatha Christie. And she's so wrapped up in the English murder mystery. I was nowhere near the scene of the crime. I was nowhere around at the time. Someone dropped arsenic in Mr. Robinson's wine.
Whoa! Did you know that Agatha Christie rhymes with murder mystery? I didn't know that either. We're talking to Larry Baker and Jessica Fish. These are the production stage manager and the director of the play. And Then There Were None, that's currently playing at the Drury Lane Theater. Fabulous. Just exciting. Tell us, for people who have never seen the play or the movie, what are some of the highlights of going to the Drury Lane to see this very interesting play that has been, first published some 76 years ago?
Well, I think the thing that we really accomplished with our production is it's incredibly stylish. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that's Drury Lane, that's a trademark of Drury Lane in general. But we have a beautiful Art Deco set by scenic designer Andrew Boyce. The costumes, Jessica Papps is our costume designer. They are so gorgeous, period costumes. I mean,
our lighting.
Our lighting, Driscoll-Otto. I mean, it's just, it's a spectacular feast for the eyes, the mm-hmm. actual, like, world of the play. We've got a scene that takes place entirely in the dark.
Thank you, Driscoll, for putting us in the dark.
Yes, that's a sign of a good lighting designer, when you're comfortable to turn off the lights.
Thunder and lightning, and then the power goes out.
And you're on an island, and you're being murdered one by one.
Yeah.
Ooh.
One by one. And then we also have a beautiful scene that's done in candlelight because there's no longer power in the house. And yeah, our prop designer Cassie created some amazing blood effects with her own special recipe. And so you not only hear about the offstage murders, but you get to see the residual effect as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about, there's an event that's coming up this Saturday for mm-hmm. people who are interested in this kind of thing. Why don't you tell us about it?
Sure. We're doing every weekend, Drury Lane hosts a high tea, and we're doing a murder mystery high tea. I'll be there helping to host the event, reading some sections from the novel, and we're going to be having all kinds of puzzles and games to get people's brains working before the show so that you can be the best armchair sleuth possible.
Unleash your inner detective.
Yeah, I love it.
I hope we have some Agatha Christie mega fans there.
Yeah. I hope so, too. I'm going to give out the number because we have a gift certificate for two tickets to the Drury Lane Theater, and I've given out them before. Thank you, Larry Baker. Mm-hmm. But people have just called me back to thank me so much. And
you know,
Drury Lane is in the suburbs, and I think there are people who are snobby and say, well, it's not in Chicago, it's not the same quality, it's a suburban theater, and that's different. That is so not the case, because I've probably been to five or so of your plays there, and I'm telling you, they're as high quality as anything that I've seen even on Broadway.
Excellent.
Well, thanks.
Your actors come in from all over, right? I mean,
sure.
It's not just local actors. I mean, everything is just top of the line. And I really highly recommend that people go out there. And a lot of people don't like to drive down to the city of Chicago.
That's
right. They just don't. And this is easy. You park
and free
and
parking. Free parking.
Yeah.
Free parking.
Have dinner
we
in
have
the
a
restaurant.
We have a bar. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
make an event of it. And there's eight shows a week. So you can see a matinee. You can see an evening show.
Right, right. Okay, 981-7200. Who has the answer? The answer to the trivia question. Jessica, why don't you give us the trivia question once again?
Sure. Agatha Christie, upon finding out that her husband was cheating on her, set up her own disappearance and disappeared for this many days before being found.
Okay. The first caller now, because no one's calling in. No one wants these tickets.
Come on,
they're very valuable. 981-7200. So, Jessica, you look very young, and you are very young. And is it still an unusual thing for a woman to be a director in this kind of theater, these kind of theater productions?
I started my career in New York. I lived there for many years before coming to Chicago for graduate school. And what actually brought me out here for graduate school was the master's program up at Northwestern is actually run by two phenomenal women directors. And I really was looking for that kind of mentorship and someone to look up to and say, how are you doing this? Because it has been a boys' club for a long time, and there are some incredible women making theater currently, and the generation just above me who really paved that road for us. And Drury Lane, there's an incredible female director coming in right behind me, starting rehearsal tomorrow, Lillianne Brown on The Color Purple. So I'm really proud of that.
You know, if I can ask you, like, for instance, people ask me about being a lawyer, being a female, and, you know, there's now 50-50 females and males in law school. Not all women, though, rise up to the ranks because of many reasons. But, you know, what is the difference being a female lawyer? And I say there are some real upsides, which are, you know, women can be better negotiators. They can be better listeners in some cases. They can be more compassionate. And I think they have a soft touch sometimes, which the cases need, the clients need. And even sometimes the judges want to see some compassion and some reason rather than the kind of yelling and screaming that you sometimes think of, right?
So, I love that, Karen.
So as a director, using that same template, what are your skills that you think are maybe uniquely female or feminine that maybe help you in doing your job?
I mean, I think that being a woman in America prepared me to be a good negotiator, quite frankly. I think that I know how to get what I want, how to speak for what I need, but I also know that the loudest voice is not necessarily proof of being the smartest voice in the room. So I know how to be clear about what I want, but I also know that the way to get it is not necessarily just banging my head against the wall. And I think that also I'm a great listener, and I think that the job of director is trying to get everybody to do their best work. That's your role. Bring out the best in everybody, help them to achieve their greatness. And I think that is that a characteristic that's uniquely feminine? Who knows? Maybe not. But I think that that's certainly a byproduct of the world that
it
I
sounds,
grew up
sounds
in.
Like a little nurturing. You know, you're, mm-hmm. you look at your role as not getting people to bend to my will, but rather a female kind of... I'm just, again, these are real generalizations. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're, that all women have these traits and all men don't have these traits. But the idea is that, you know, I'm nurturing you to do a good job so that we're all happy.
Yeah, and I think that also... being a woman director, you know, you have to have a tough skin. I think that it's a business
sure.
that expects me to do the same work as my male colleagues and do it twice as well and look good doing it.
Right.
And I really.
And wearing high heels.
Backwards
doing it.
And high heels.
Backwards and high heels. I remember that one.
And you know, I work very hard to not let them see me sweat.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And you're not sweating now. So I think we have an answer to the question. How long was Agatha Christie, how long did she disappear when she staged her own disappearance? Bob McKankakee claims that he has the answer. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have the answer.
Okay, what is it?
She was gone for 10 days.
Yes, Bob.
Good job, Bob.
Bob is the winner of a gift certificate for two tickets. You are going to love. Have you been to Drury Lane?
Oh yeah!
Oh,
I love
good.
It.
Well,
excellent. Welcome back.
You'll say hello to Jessica and Larry. You'll just take them right off the stage and insist on saying hello to them. Are you an Agatha Christie fan? Are you?
Oh yes, yeah. I am. I mean, who isn't, right?
Yeah, no, she's great. Ben, you're going to get his address, and thank you for calling in. Thanks, Bob. Take care. Good luck.
Thank you so
much. And tell
me
how it goes.
Thank you.
Enjoy.
Okay. All right, so the next play that is going to be performed, when does that start? That's Color Purple.
The Color Purple starts rehearsal tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lillian
Brown directing, local Chicago cast. And we're very excited about
another adaptation from an amazing book too.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. And so you do your rehearsals, and then when do you start? When does it start?
We have 3 weeks of rehearsal, and then we start previews. We have a week of previews, and then we open. So and that's it's a nice long run as well. And we always do a play over the summer, and then we start up our fall again with a musical. Then we've got Mary Poppins for Christmas, and then An American in Paris, a beautiful dance show. So it's a great season this season.
Who picks what gets performed?
The team
that goes into it.
Our artistic director, our producer, and there's a lot that goes into it, and also writes what's available.
Right.
You know, you want the hottest, you know, thing that you can get, and the hot ticket that's out there that everybody wants to see, what's new and what's exciting.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jessica Fitch, the director of And Then There Were None, and Larry Baker, who is the production stage manager at the Drury Lane. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having
us.
All right, take care. We'll come back in a little bit. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. We're going to talk a little bit about success. Success in business, but also success in life. Same sets of skills, same types of things apply. And we have a guest who is near and dear to my heart. I've known Damian Mason for over 20 years. He's a speaker, a podcaster, a writer. He studied at Second City. He gives motivational speeches. He knows a lot about a lot of things. And he's written a book called Do Business Better, which is a great book. I just read it. And it applies to business, but again, it applies to life in general. Welcome to the show, Damian. How are you?
Hey, Karen. Thanks so much for having me on.
So glad to be talking to you. Let's talk just generally about definitions, because sometimes definitions are important in that they kind of structure how you act in life. So success, how do you define success?
Yeah, so one thing that we all must do as we get older, and you and I are not, we're not in our 20s anymore, we got to look at how we do what we do and say, all right, when I was 20, I thought success looked like this. When I was 30, I thought it looked like this. It's fine to have an evolving view of success. It's important to never, though, let go of a vision of success for you, because I think that some people, and I talk about this in my book, they just give up and they say, no, I'm really happy. This isn't bad. Well, isn't bad doesn't mean good. And so I always say, yeah, it's normal to evolve and have a different picture of success, but you've got to always maintain a picture of success. For me, it's about wealth, fulfillment, location. It's about life by choice more and more as I get older, being able to turn down things that I don't want to do.
Yeah, and I think as we get older, we just have such a lower tolerance for doing things that are outside, not our comfort zone, because I still think it's a good idea to do things outside comfort zone, but things you just don't want to do. And, you know, I guess, you know, thinking about your book, when I was reading, I'm thinking about my life, you know, you think, oh, I want to be in a big law firm, and I want to be partner, and that's what you're told is supposed to be good. And then when you get there, you realize that definition of success is not for everybody. In fact, it's not for very many people. And I'm sure a lot of people have reached a certain age where they have really redefined what their goals and what their success levels need to be.
Yeah, you look at your listeners right now, they're sitting there saying, oh, you know, things are pretty good, things are pretty good. And I say, all right, that's fine. Don't become complacent and actually then look at it and say, all right, when I was 20, I thought this. When I was 25, I thought that. When I was 35, it's normal to have a continual evolution of what you want your life to look like. There's a lot of people that I think give up and decide, oh, well, it's okay, and they accept complacency. You know, when I was 21 years old, I thought success looked like a Mustang 5.0 with a convertible with a personalized license plate, and now I could have a bunch of those convertible Mustangs sit in my garage, and that's not important to me. Now it's more about time and choice. And I think that everybody, you know, whether they have their own business, Karen, or whether they are working for some, large organization, whatever they might do, everybody can identify with what I want my life to look like. And really, that's what success is, what you want your life to look at, and more doing things of your own volition, of your own choice.
Now, Damian, let's talk a little bit about successful people and some of the traits. And you really do a good job at bullet pointing some of these things. And we have to be a little, we have to fill in the blanks here. You have done some acting. You've done some interesting comedy work, stand-up and writing. And you were in a movie, Space Travesty. And you talk about it in your book. You had a small part. And you talk about how you received advice from a famous actor. Can you tell our listeners that story? Because I think it's very instructive.
Sure. Well, actually, maybe we should start at the beginning. You and I know each other because years ago when I was a political
yes.
comedian, you hired me.
I did.
Hired me for an appearance, which I'm very excited, and that's why we've had such a great relationship. Years ago, you hired me to do an event in Chicago for an event you were holding, and I came and did my political comedy act. So to bring your listeners up to speed, my background is I'm a farm boy from Indiana that was a corporate salesperson, and I quit my job in 1994. I was working for, in fact, a Elk Grove Village, Illinois-based business called Cooper Lighting, part of Cooper Industries. I quit my sales job with Cooper Lighting to become a political comedian. And my whole thing was I wanted to be rewarded for my creativity, and I wanted to be able to do my own business. You know, I wanted to run my own thing as a creative little soul and also rewarded for my own work ethic. So after 5 years of hashing it out and running through, you go from open mic night to paid gigs to corporate events to doing events for people like Karen Conti. Then the phone rang and they said, we've got a movie role for you alongside Leslie Nielsen. We want you to play the part of Bill Clinton, because my political comedy act was unique in that I dressed up as Bill Clinton and delivered a political comedy show in the persona of Bill Clinton.
And you looked just like him, and you have to just do a little bit right this very minute to see.
Now, Karen, I knew you're going to call me about this. Now, I'll tell you something. I'm kind of getting past my prime. But I was going to tell you, I was down there to Lincoln. I was down there to President Clinton Library in Little Rock. And I got to tell you, the funniest thing is thieves broke in and stole our book. Okay. So the thing about being Bill Clinton is that I could talk just like Bill Clinton, because I had years and years of not inhaling. Just like Bill Clinton. And as I point out, in 1994, just like Bill Clinton, I was dating a 25-year-old woman, too. Okay, so my act was...
Thank you for that interlude.
Yes, thank you, yes. My act was a political comedy act, and you know, because I remember so distinctly when you became friends with me, you told me about your father had some showbiz chops and had been in showbiz, and you said, man, I've always had an affinity for people that have been able to put themselves out there and be in show business. So my act was a political comedy show where I dressed up as Bill Clinton and delivered a political comedy. I quickly learned that clubs were not for me. It was corporate events, because they tend to be smarter, you get paid better, they're more news savvy, and you can do a joke that goes left, a joke that goes right, and you can wheel in that crowd. So anyway, There it was. It's 1999. I've been doing this for 5 years. The phone rang, and it was a movie production shooting a movie called 2001, A Space Travesty, starring Leslie Nielsen. And they had me. I was the sixth character, and they always rank it by, okay, your level of fame, your number of minutes in the movie. And I played the part of Bill Clinton alongside Leslie Nielsen. In my book, Do Business Better, I point out, as you alluded to, Karen, that I really never thought myself as a actor. I never thought, okay, Damien is a movie actor. But that day, that moment, it dawns on you, you're being paid significant amounts of money. You are an actor today. This is your job. Do it well.
And you and you asked Leslie Nielsen, or Leslie Nielsen gave you some advice?
He came up to me after about the third day of me being on set with Leslie Nielsen. He said, Damien, do you want to be successful as an actor? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, I've got two words of advice for you. Get better. and it wasn't that I was bad at it necessarily. It's just that he very plainly said, this is what you're doing today. Get better at it. And I decided, you know what? By golly, this is my job today. I'm going to study him. Even though I'm a comedian, even though my normal bread and butter is doing corporate and private events where I get up as a surprise guest and make an audience laugh, today my job is to be an actor. Today my job is to make this movie the best I can make it. And so I studied. And the good thing about being on a movie set, Karen, is there are so many hours of dead time. You sit there, and all the other kids are, you know, the other actors are monkeying around, talking to one another, going over, and you know, drinking pop. And I said, wait, I'm going to use this time to get better, just like Leslie Nielsen told me to. And I studied their craft, and I watched, and I pulled them aside and said, how do I do this? How do I do that? And it made me a lot stronger.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some real practical bullet points for being successful. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show. I'm here with Damien Mason. We'll be back in a minute.
Damien.
We're here with Damien Mason, and we're talking about... Oh, we're talking about life. We're talking about success and his book, Do Business Better. Let's talk, Damien, about the four traits of entrepreneurial success. And I think that we can extrapolate that to mean success in almost any work you're doing. Can you bullet point those pretty quickly and tell our listeners what they mean?
Yeah, so I was a guest at an entrepreneur class, and whether your listener is an entrepreneur, a retired person, or works in a large organization, everybody can relate to this. They, meaning the average person that says, okay, what's it going to take to succeed? They think it's about business plans, it's about mission statements, and it's about some sort of big overlaying, extensive amount of planning, and really it comes down to traits. If you want to be successful, you have risk tolerance. You understand that the world's a risky place and you can navigate it, and you mitigate your own risk by being more talented or by being more hardworking and by being forward-looking. Second trait of success is drive. You know, it's not something you're born with. There's no such thing as an ambition gene. You want to be successful, you go out and hustle, and you know this. Obviously, you've run your own business, Karen, for a long, long time. Third trait of success is resilience. The world knocks you down. We know that it's not easy to go out there every day and put yourself on the line, and there's going to be people that chip at you. There's going to be competition. There's going to be up days, bad quarters. You've got to be able to bounce back. As I always say, when you had a high school coach, they said the hardest person to beat is the person that refuses to be beaten. That is true. Fourth trait of success is vision. Where are you going, and what are you going to have to look past? Most people get hung up on some sort of minor obstacle that's in front of them and can't get beyond that. No. Where are you going? That's your vision.
You know, a couple of things interest me about that section in your book, and we're talking about drive, and kind of you're talking about discipline. Basically, driven people do things they don't want to do. And excuse me. And, you know, I always laugh because, as you probably know, I know you're very much of a fitness person. I am as well. And people say, oh, gosh, you really enjoy that workout. Wow, you're really happy going to work out. You know what? I hate it every day. I hate to work out. I like the results. I like how I feel. I know it's the right thing. I know it's, but I force myself to do it because I guess I'm disciplined. But there's nothing happy about being disciplined. It's doing things you don't want to do, right?
Yeah, so you've run your own law firm. You've been your own business person. You have your own radio show. You know that it's about 20% talent and 80% actually making it happen. It's about going out every day and executing the fundamentals that make it come together. It's about doing. It's not about some like lightning strike. There's a lot of people sitting around saying, man, if I just had the right idea, if I just had this lucky break. You know, usually it's about just doing. I'm not a great joke writer. I'm not the most talented person when it comes to comedic delivery, and I started out in comedy. What dawned on me was there's a lot of people that are more comedically talented than me back 25 years ago when I started out, and you know what, Karen? They don't have the discipline to work every day at perfecting and putting on a presentation and then driving it like a business.
And let's talk about resilience, because I think that's one of the things that you said was hardest to develop. And again, resilience, the idea that you can bounce back from bad things that happen to you. I think my opinion, Damien, is that young people are having difficulty with that trait, because I think a lot of parents, as we all know, are enabling their children and kind of being there as a safety net at all points in their lives. And then when they go to college or they go out on their own, they've never failed. They've never been told they did something wrong. And so they really they're not resilient. You give three quick examples of that. Yeah, go ahead. I was going to talk about the Michael Jordan, Tom Brady, and Abraham Lincoln. I love those three examples.
Go ahead. I like the fact that you're using those examples. They're good examples.
Yeah, go ahead and tell our listeners the examples and how that explains how important resilience is.
Okay, to me, resilience is the most important trait when it comes to being successful in any endeavor in your life and your entire life. It's going to be about your bounce back factor. Resilience, you can call it tenaciousness. You can call it your bounce back factor. Whatever it is, it's really about the fact that. Success is not easy. I wanted to run my own business. I wanted to come being the youngest of nine kids from a fairly modest background on a farm in Indiana. I wanted to do my own thing, create my own destiny, and have my own business. And there are a lot of forces that go against that. You know, you don't have the right education. You don't have the right money. You don't have the right background. And so while you get knocked down, it makes the strong stronger. And unfortunately, there is a situation in the United States of America. We are such a well-off country, and we have well-intentioned parents. And they say things like, and you've heard this, I don't want my kid to have to do what I had to do.
Yep.
And that actually does them no favors.
No, that's absolutely right. And tell the listeners just briefly about the Michael Jordan, Tom Brady, Abraham Lincoln examples.
So Michael Jordan, as we maybe know, and you're obviously there in WGN, and you got all those wonderful Chicago listeners, and they know about Michael Jordan. You know, Michael Jordan did get cut from a basketball team. Michael Jordan, arguably the best basketball player of all time, had a lot of setbacks, believe it or not. He was not always going to be the varsity, the stud, the number 23 that they're going to give the ball to. He earned that because he had setbacks. Tom Brady was a 12th round draft pick. He didn't even start for his college football team until his senior year. And, of course, Abraham Lincoln, another great Illinois example, since we're talking to the friends of WGN. Abraham Lincoln had failure after failure after failure. If Abraham Lincoln had not persevered and had the resilience, what would the United States have become? He preserved the Union and kept it together during arguably the worst, darkest days of the United States of America. So those three examples, to me, are like what we can all dig down to and say, what am I not doing? What am I not, where am I not being tough enough? Because seriously, we all can get knocked around and we can say, okay, this isn't for me. Well, that's a bunch of crap. What it comes down to is you've got to then suit up and go out and play again. And also you can learn resilience. You can always remember your setbacks, and it makes you stronger.
It really does. There's no question about it. Successful people don't make excuses. That's one of your mantras in the book. And, you know, you give an example that I found interesting. There was a Wall Street Journal article that you referenced that said 82% of renters in a building say fitness center is really important. 82% said that. And 55% said, I wouldn't even rent in a building without one, yet 42% rarely use the fitness center. So people,
yeah, and that's self-reporting. And that's self-reporting, Karen, which is the funny part. If the reality was, if you'd actually did a time and activity study, it would probably be a far less amount that actually do use it. So people say a lot of things. They say, I'm going to do this. This is very important to me. But remember, actions speak louder than words. People always put their money and their time into what really matters to them. You can say, I care about being with my family. And if you're not spending time with your family, you're not putting effort into it, what are you really saying? And the same thing with fitness, same thing with your work achievement. You still keep up with everything with your business, and you probably are still reading articles, and you're looking at things and saying, this is what I'm going to do. But there are folks that say, I'm doing all those things, and I've got a new theory on that, and I call it the did versus do. You don't go to the gym if you went to the gym in January. You don't keep up with your business if you actually read a publication and did some continual learning back in 2014. You did those things. Are you doing those things? No, you once did them.
And, and going back to this idea of excuses, when I read it, I realized, sometimes I thought about some recent things that happened to me and my firm and things that are going on. And I remember saying some things that sounded like I was making an excuse. And I really needed to go back and think about it and say, no, I'm not going to make that excuse. I'm going to say I am responsible for that in whatever way. Were there contributing factors outside of my control? Yes, but I can handle it differently and I can handle it better. And you're right in the book. Excuses are really an easy way for people to just walk away from things that they do have a little bit of control over.
I make the point in Do Business Better, Karen, about what I call the myth of inadequate resources. It's my favorite thing. My wife is actually in the other room right now. She's watching HGTV, and one of my favorite examples is everybody on HGTV in that show House Hunters, they walk into a house, and they say, oh, goodness, we should buy this house. We could entertain our friends. We don't entertain where we are now because we don't have the right space, to which I would say, no, that's not the real reason. It's because you're too lazy and because you're not entertaining. Don't blame the fact that you don't have a food table in your basement. we all can make up excuses and say we don't have this, we don't have that. It comes down to this thing of a myth of inadequate resources when we all do actually probably have what we need. It's just that we lack the gumption and the push to make it happen.
Damian Mason, we're going to have to break off here, but thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell our listeners where they can get your book, Do Business Better, and where they can contact you?
Thank you, Karen. It's DamianMason.com, D-A-M-I-A-N, DamianMason.com. You can find all my social media. I'd love for your listeners to keep up with me. I'm on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook. I would love for and you keep up with me, and I really appreciate that because we have such a long history from, 25 years now, you and I.
Yeah, I think that's right. All right.
So, yes, and they can find a link to Do Business Better there. So thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care. Welcome back. Karen Conti here. Now is the time that I am answering your legal questions. As usual, 8 to 9 is the time you can call in and ask me any question that you have regarding any topic. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. I'm a practicing lawyer. I've practiced law for about 33 years, and I've practiced in a lot of different areas. I do a lot of family law now. I do some employment, but I practiced in the area of criminal law and commercial litigation. So I know a little bit about some things, and I may not have the exact answer for you, but I can certainly try to steer you in the right direction. 312-981-7200. I also welcome questions about the news. I know there's a lot of topics that are in the news that have a legal twist to them, and if you have a question about how these things work or what you have an opinion about something that's happening, I would like to have you weigh in. The other thing is that I am a practicing lawyer, and if you would like to talk to me off the air, I'm happy to either talk to you or email with you to try to steer you in the right direction, refer you to a lawyer maybe in your area who practices in the area where you need representation. Or sometimes I just give you a little bit of information to help you along the way. 312, this is my office number, 312-332-7800. And that's a confidential line. You can leave a message there with a very brief description of your problem or your issue, where you live, when it happened, and what it is that you are seeking. And the really best way to reach me is the email, because then I can turn around and just email you back. And that email address is WGN@AskKarenConti.com. A-S-K, my name, Karen Conti, K-A-R-E-N-C-O-N-T-I.com. So Ben is going to be taking your calls, and he's going to be kind of getting a little summary of what your issue is, and then we'll get you right on the air, and hopefully we'll get to all of your calls. I see Matthew in Burbank is on the phone. I'll get to you in 1 minute. Jerry, my husband, Jerry. Jerry, you and I have been kind of chatting about this issue all weekend. You want to put it out there for everyone to hear?
Sure. You know, I've got a question about this 75-year-old man who shot and killed a 14-year-old boy, who with a number of cohorts, some of the kids were 17, 18, they stole a car, they're up in Gurnee. I guess one of them was threatening him. And now they are charging the kids, the other kids, with murder, because the law basically says that. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, it's controversial, and even lawyers disagree about this kind of thing. I mean, there's a concept called felony murder. About 44 states have this, and it goes way back to England. So this is not something new. This is something that dates way back to hundreds of years ago. And what it says is that if you are committing a forcible crime, meaning a violent crime, let's just use those words, and someone dies in the course of it, you can be held responsible even if you didn't actually cause that death yourself. So in the extreme, let's say that Jerry, you and I say, Jerry, we're going to go rob the 7-Eleven. So you get in the car with me. You know I'm going there to rob the 7-Eleven. Let's say I have a toy gun. I don't even have a gun. I couldn't even kill someone if I wanted to. I walk in. You're waiting there as the getaway driver, right?
Yes.
And someone in the store sees me pull out my toy gun, and someone in the store tries to defend and ends up killing the owner, let's just say. Well, I can be responsible for the death of that owner, even though I didn't pull the trigger. And you, as the getaway driver, can also be responsible for that death because you were committing a felony by helping me commit that crime, and it was a forcible felony because it was a armed robbery, even though I wasn't really armed, and someone died in the course of it. So is that fair? I don't know. I mean, do you think that's fair?
You know, as much as I'm very socially liberal, when it comes to law and order, yeah, I think it's fair. Somebody died because of an action that you were partaking in. So who's going to pay the price? I'm really for it. I mean, I know these are young kids. But when you're 75 years old and you've got four or five young, strong people threatening you, they're the deadly weapon.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess, you know, interestingly, I looked into it, and there's a bill that has just been introduced by, of all people, Representative Justin Slaughter. I'm not going to make fun of that, but he's an interesting person who brought up this bill. But the bill would be that it would take away the right to charge someone who for felony murder unless that person personally inflicted the murder. So in this case, according to this bill that's being proposed, the other five boys would not be, I guess there was a girl there too, the young people would not be charged with that murder because they didn't purposely, intentionally inflict the harm. You know, I feel compromised. I mean, I would hope that people would say to themselves, gosh, I don't want to commit a crime because if something happens and someone pulls out a gun, and now everyone has guns because we all have concealed carry, right? You're seeing that more and more now, that people have guns during carjackings and are using them to defend their home and their property, that it might happen that someone gets killed. And listen, even if you don't kill anyone, even if you don't even have a weapon, you could be charged with murder. Does that deter young people? Does that deter anybody from committing a crime? I'd like the answer to that question, because then maybe I could argue that this is a good law. Otherwise, I just don't know. If someone doesn't personally inflict the harm, should we be charging that person, especially people who are 15, 16 years old?
Well, you know, I'm really tired of giving everybody an an excuse and a break. You know, I don't care what your mother said to you when you were 6 years old. You're a criminal. You're creating crime. You know right from wrong. It has nothing to do with race. It has a lot to do probably with lack of education and poverty. But the law is the law. Crime is crime. And, you know, I don't think they should be sentenced to death or anything, but I think they have to pay some price for this.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. And I think that, you know, if you want to weigh in on that, I'm happy to put you on the air. 312-981-7200, the felony murder rule is what it's called. And you can look it up. And there's some really good history about that. Let's go to the phone lines here. Matthew from Burbank, welcome to WGN. How are you?
Real good.
Hi, Matthew. What's your legal question?
My legal question is I just got out of the IODC custody 4 weeks ago, and I had a case that was handled back in 2010, and my sentence was 5 years at 2 years of MSR, and they had changed it on 2012 to 3 years to life parole. And when
Hold on, Matthew. I'm really confused. Can you let me just ask you the question? What is the question you're going to ask me? You're asking me about it.
The question is that I got this case. I did a post conviction case in April 19th, and now I just got out. I'd like to know if I can get this back in court.
Okay. I'm going to put you on hold, and I want you to contact my office because I need a little bit more coherent facts about the case. You're using words like post-conviction, and you just got out, and I don't even know what the crime is. So, Ben, why don't you give him my email address, and I'll give it to everybody, wgn@askkarenconti.com. I don't mean to be short, but I don't think I was going to get the right facts here to give you a coherent answer back. Ross in Buffalo Grove. Hi, Ross. How are you?
Hi, Karen.
Hi. Do you have a legal question for me?
Basically, when my wife had a workman's comp claim, we retained a lawyer, filled out the paperwork, filed the lawsuit, and then the law group split up. And I want to know what happens now. Do we have to fill out paperwork again? Does our lawyer have to...
Interesting. So the lawyer who was handling your case, do you know, did he stay in the firm or did he start his own practice with other lawyers?
He said he was going to start his own practice.
Okay. So I think you should call the law firm, the last known number, and ask who is handling your case. If you want this gentleman to continue to represent you, you're going to have to, you know, sometimes the firm may not be really willing to give out his new number. But if you ask them and you say, this is my attorney and he's representing me, you can demand that you get that information. And then probably he's going to have his business up and running very quickly. I would imagine that this is not going to fall between the cracks. I hope it doesn't. Law firms split up all the time. People usually decide what cases they're going to take with them. So it's already probably been decided where your case is going. But just make sure, Ross, that you stay strong. And if you really want that lawyer, you know, don't let them substitute another lawyer if you don't want substitution. You have a right to have the lawyer represent you no matter what firm he or she is in. Okay? Does that make sense?
Yes, but the paperwork that we signed with the first law group, will that have to be re-signed with this individual lawyer that we're going to keep?
Yeah, it probably will, but it won't really impact anything other than just instead of the firm name that you had on the document, the retainer agreement, it'll have this new firm or the new lawyer. But it's not going to take away any of your money. It's not going to take away any of your rights. It's just going to be a substitute contract. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Good luck. Good luck with your case.
Okay, thanks.
All right, take care. When we come back, I'm going to be taking more legal questions. I got Jason in Chicago and Daniel in Aurora. We're going to get to you. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. This is the time I'm answering your legal questions. Ben is taking the calls, and he's kind of sifting through and getting the facts from you, and you're going to get on the air, and I'll try to help you as best I can. 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. We have Sarah Parker. Jason from Chicago? I think it's Jason. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show. Hi. Hello.
Hello, yes.
Oh, is this Sarah?
No, this is Mary.
Okay. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Oh, hi. I got a question for you.
Sure.
You know what? I was incarcerated for, like, I had gotten an accident, like, we'll say 10 years ago, actually. I hit somebody and I had insurance or whatever. So 5 years later down the line, the lady went to sue me. But since I didn't have no insurance, I was being taken to court. But and that time I was in jail. I was incarcerated. Okay, and so somebody gave my brother a summons for me to go to court. But then I called the lawyer and told him that I was in jail. And so I said, my brother said, well, you know, I'll go down there for you. He says, you don't have to do that. You know, everything will be taken care of. So my brother said, are you sure? He said, yeah, you don't have to.
Okay, Mary, well, then, Mary, hold on.
Like,
hold
6 on. Months later.
Okay, hold on. So
I'm sorry.
So you're incarcerated and you're getting summoned in the civil case? They're trying to sue you? Is that what they're...
No, yeah, they're trying to sue... Well, they're trying to sue me.
Okay,
that's what
and
it
so
was.
What ended up happening? Let's get to the very...
So what happened is they went to court and they said that my brother didn't have to go in my place. They sued me for $60,000.
They got a judgment against you?
Yes.
Okay.
I was incarcerated, then I was incarcerated for another 5 years, so that's 9 years altogether. I just got out recently. I was wondering if I can go back into court and get that off my record.
Okay. I don't know the answer to that, but the idea that you were incarcerated at the time, you couldn't come and defend yourself. So the question is, are you able to vacate that judgment based upon you were unavailable and you couldn't be there?
Right.
And did they serve you in prison personally?
No, they didn't serve me. They served my brother. My brother was at home, and they just... They had some guy serve him and summons to go to court.
So it sounds like
he knew I was in prison, but he said that didn't make no difference.
Okay, well, so you weren't living there, so the summons was probably the service was probably improper, and so you could go into court and vacate the $60,000 judgment. So you would have to file a motion to vacate. You'd have to show the records that you were in prison. You have to show that you were never served with that document. But the problem is that the judgment, they could then proceed again, even if you win that motion to vacate. Is what we're calling it, and you could still get hit up with the $60,000 because if that's what the damages were to the car and to the injuries that you caused, you might still end up with that. So the question is, maybe you should file for bankruptcy. And again, I don't know if bankruptcy would cover and discharge that particular debt. So what I would probably do is contact a bankruptcy lawyer and ask them the very narrow question of, is this judgment, even if this judgment is entered against me, can I get it discharged in bankruptcy? Because $60,000 is a lot of money, and you're coming out of prison. You probably don't have a lot of good employment options, and it would be very hard, if not impossible, for you to ever pay this off. So bankruptcy might be the way to go. And if you need a referral, I'm going to put you on hold, and I can give you that if you email my office. Okay? That's WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Let's go to John in Inverness. Hi, John. You wanted to weigh in on the case of the 75-year-old man up in Gurnee who shot and killed the 14-year-old, one of six young people who were stealing his car. You wanted to weigh in on that.
Right. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that as a matter of policy, we want to enforce the felony murder rule because if someone is willing to conspire to commit a crime, then they should be willing to face the consequences of that crime, even if they're not consequences that were initially intended. And I understand that the 14-year-old, that's pretty young, but I don't know if I'd say it's too young to have to face those kinds of consequences.
And, I sort of agree with you that, if you want to commit crime, let the chips fall where they may, because whenever you commit a crime, you are risking that someone's going to pull out a gun. In this day and age, people have guns now, right? Even, legally, they have legal guns.
Right.
But the question is, do people really think about the consequences of what they're doing? And if this is to deter people from doing bad things, does a 14-year-old, these kids, what a stupid thing to do, right? They steal a car in Chicago. They drive all the way up north, probably took them an hour and a half to get there. They're stealing a car that's not even as old as the kid who got killed, or that's as old as the kid who got killed. And, it obviously a lot of thought didn't go into this. I just feel like it might be overextending culpability here. That's kind of my feeling. But I hear what you're saying, that you gotta put the responsibility in the people who are doing these bad things.
Well, you're right, right. And I understand exactly what you're saying about it providing a deterrent. I don't know that it does, but I don't think that we should eliminate it because we don't know that it doesn't.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And I think there is some thought that we need to be fair with our laws and that even if there is no deterrent, I mean, I think that's one of the arguments with capital punishment. Capital punishment is pretty much, it's pretty much clear that deterrence is not that people aren't deterred with capital punishment. People are going to murder, they're going to murder, they don't think about it. But there's a sense of fairness for some people that says, you know what, if you kill somebody in a horrible way, maybe you deserve to die, and maybe our laws should provide for that kind of justice. Not sure I agree with that, but I understand that argument.
Oh, sure. No, I understand. I totally understand, and I agree with you that as far as capital punishment being a deterrent, I don't think that it's ever been established that it is. And the only real effect that you get is the feeling of, you said, what I would call retributive justice, where you get the feeling that people are going to get what they deserve. Right. In this instance, I don't know if this 14-year-old is going to be subject to capital punishment, but insofar as whether or not it's a deterrent, I think I would, without any sort of empirical data to back it up, I think I would err on the side of keeping it in case it is a deterrent.
Gotcha. Thank you for the call, John. A very thoughtful call. Appreciate it. There would be no capital punishment because it's a state crime and Illinois has abolished the death penalty, and it probably wouldn't, and it wouldn't, certainly wouldn't be something a 14-year-old would be subject to, because the Supreme Court has said that if you're going to give capital punishment, it has to be someone over the age of 18. We are going to continue to take your legal calls, 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. It's the Karen Conti Show. I'm taking all of your legal questions now, or anything that you want to talk about from the news that has some legal aspect to it. I'm a practicing lawyer, so I'm going to try to help you to answer your questions. 312-981-7200. And you can text me to that same number. If you don't reach me here, or you'd like to talk to me outside off the air, my number at the office is 312-332-7800. Better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. Or if you have ideas for shows, I've got a lot of nice listeners who have ideas and things that they're interested in that I might cover. So I'm happy to take your emails. Let's go to John in Florida. Hi, John. Welcome to the show. Thank you for holding. Hi,
Karen. I like listening to your podcast.
Oh, good. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Do you have a
question?
Sure.
So, with the new law for marijuana in Illinois, 20 years ago, I had a possession. It's probably off my record, but I don't know. And can I get it expunged? Using the internet.
Sure. Do you know how many grams that you were caught with?
Under a quarter.
Okay. So the new law is a pretty broad scope. It's called the Cannabis Regulation and Tax Act. And it goes into effect, I believe, in 2020, I assume first in January. And basically, it's going to give about 700,000 people, more than that, the ability to get these kind of things expunged. And if it's under 30 grams, I believe it's going to be very simple for you to do this if it's not already off your record. But then if it's over a certain number of grams, like between 30 and 500, you have to petition the court, and it's a little more involved. I do not know exactly how that's going to be done, if that's something that you need to hire a lawyer for or can be done. My guess is that they're going to make it easy. There is a group called the Marijuana Policy Project. I would Google that organization, and I would keep up to speed on what the procedure is going to be to get these things expunged. And the other thing that you might want to do is to run a search to see if that is still on your record. My guess is it probably still is, unless you've had it expunged, but you're going to want to get that information as well. And you can do that either through going to court and having someone there run a search of your criminal record, or hiring a private investigator to do that for you to make sure that, you know, you're not taking all these actions for nothing. Okay?
Thank you.
All right, John. Take care. Good luck with that. Let's go to Daniel in Aurora. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi. My question is basically, in 2018 in October, My fiance got pregnant. We didn't know they were twins, but we didn't know at the time. And her place fired her because she called in 2 out of the 3 days that she was scheduled to work. And she got fired without any notice. She found out because she just didn't get a schedule in the next week. And we kind of went around to, like, local attorneys, but they really didn't give us a for sure answer. She did do unemployment for a little while, but Illinois went around and they, you know, found out the actual true facts. They were trying to claim that she was a no-call, no-show. But I was saying is could she still try to get money back from them or for firing her through discriminatory reasons?
Yeah. Was she pregnant at the time, and was the reason for her absences?
Yeah, she was pregnant, and they say that she was fired because she was a no-call, no-show. But we had proof that she called in like she should have, so there shouldn't have been that grounds for her to be fired. She was fired pretty much because she was unable to work. Well, she was calling in because of morning sickness because of the fact that she was pregnant.
And was she, this sounds like a stupid question, but did the employer know she was pregnant? Was she visibly pregnant and didn't know?
They knew that she was pregnant. We didn't know at the time we were pregnant with twins.
Okay, well, that doesn't matter. Okay.
She knew that she was pregnant, though. Okay. She had notified them that she was pregnant and everything, and they still fired her.
Okay, Daniel, I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to answer your question. Generally speaking, yes, you cannot fire someone due to a lot of things like gender and race and age and pregnancy. And interestingly, I've handled a lot of these cases where women are fired because they're pregnant, and sometimes bosses don't even understand and don't even know that they can't do that, and will say things like, oh, you know, you're going to be out anyway, so we might as well fire you now. So, nope, can't do that. So the question here is going to be, did the employers do it for the reason that she was pregnant, or did they just think she didn't call in? Now, they're going to say, this is for another reason. We didn't care if she was pregnant. But if you are in a situation like this, and that is going to be a fact question, Daniel, I would say I would refer you to somebody who practices in that area. You would have a right to sue under the Illinois Human Rights Act and under the EEOC laws. Generally speaking, I'm not sure if you're going to be under the statute of limitations. You're going to be close on that one. So why don't you send me an email? I'll tell you if the statute of limitations is run. And then maybe what you do is just file it with the Illinois Department of Human Rights. It's a free service to chart, to file it. There's no filing fee. And then you can put your case together. And again, you're going to have to prove that the reason that they did it was because she was pregnant, and that there was no other good reason that they did that. She was an otherwise good employee, and they just didn't want to deal with someone who was pregnant. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Michelle in Grays Lake. Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Good, Karen. How are you today?
Good. Do you have a legal question for me?
Yes, I do. I was wondering, we had had kind of like a breach of contract. We had signed up with a home care facility for my dad, and there was kind of like a deal if you paid a year, a year in advance, then if anything were to happen or he were to leave that facility, we would get the money refunded within 30 days. And unfortunately, he passed away like within a month, and so we're sort of owed like 11 months. And the facility did try to pay back some. However, we are still owed about like $38,000.
Wow. Okay.
And so, so we can't go to small claims court. And when I spoke to the woman, she said, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, we could get a lawyer. She doesn't care. It won't affect anything.
Michelle, let me ask you, is this a private company or is this a...
An LLC, Limited Liability Corp.
Okay, and so
and,
why...
she owns four houses.
Okay, and so why are they... What is the reason? Are they just saying they don't have the money, or do they acknowledge that they owe the money back?
Yes. Oh, yeah. She acknowledges she owes it. And then I did see she showed a list like she owes 10 other people money also, like in addition to us, I don't know, were they also paid in advance and then maybe the person passed away or they're no longer going there?
Well, this is really disturbing. Have you dealt with their licensing agency? I don't know exactly what that would be, because if people are taking money like this and they're not putting it in a reserve, it seems like they're defrauding people. I mean, this is,
right,
you know,
kind of like a Ponzi scheme.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, why don't you send me an email? Maybe I can refer you to someone who can help you. But generally speaking, $38,000, that's enough to sue over. And you can do that yourself. I mean, you could fill out the paperwork. It's a breach of contract. You can even say in the paperwork that you file with the court that they acknowledge that they owed it and, in fact, paid you some of the money back, but they owe you the rest of it. And then you would go to court and get your judgment against them. And then you would probably at that point want to hire a collection lawyer. And collection lawyers then will put liens on property. They will try to garnish wages. They can find bank accounts and they can put a lien on the bank account so that you can get the money from their bank accounts and any other assets that they might have. So I wouldn't discount going to court and getting that judgment. But I would also see if you can put some pressure on them, because they might lose their licensing if they can't pay this money back. It sounds like a horrible thing. Your poor dad died and you have this money that you're owed and now you have to hire a lawyer. I mean, it's just, that's really unfortunate.
Right. But good luck to you.
All right. And if you need a collection lawyer at the end of this, because I wouldn't hire a lawyer to get the judgment. I would try to do it yourself, you know, even though it's not in your comfort zone, and then get the collection lawyer to do it. And these lawyers will do that on a contingent basis, meaning they will just take from the judgment, you know, their fees, so you don't have to pay up front. Okay?
Okay.
All right, Michelle. Okay, good luck. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. And then, so should I go ahead and just send you an email? Go ahead and try to...
No, go ahead. Send me an email, and I'll put you on hold, and I'll give out my email address, WGN@AskKarenConti.com, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. And I'm going to be continuing to take your legal questions. I've got some people on hold. I'm going to try to get to all of you. 981-7200 or text to 981-7200. You're listening to Karen Conti Show on WGN. You still have time for legal questions. 981-7200, 981-7200. A texter asked me, what is the statute of limitations for medical malpractice? Generally speaking, it's 2 years from the date of the incident, or there's some other rules that if you didn't discover the malpractice, there's some extensions of that, but it's something that you should definitely talk to a lawyer about. I'm happy to listen to your situation and tell you what the statute of limitations might be, and or refer you to somebody who handles those kinds of cases. But generally speaking, you have 2 years from the date that the incident happened. Let's go to Margaret in Skokie. Hi, Margaret. How are you?
Well, hi, Karen. Love your program.
Thank you.
This is a general question. Just about every day or every other day, we hear about hit-and-run accidents where people, leave the accident, and in many cases, whether they seriously injured the person or landed up killing the person, they have taken off. I guess I want to know, and I'm sure many other people want to know, does our city, state, or law in any way have a minimum sentence or something, 10, 15 years, when somebody leaves the scene of an accident in which a person is seriously hurt or killed? And if we don't, how can we get one? This is horrible, and it's frightening, and it seems to happen just about every day.
Margaret, you know what? I don't know the answer. This is one of those things that I would just have to look it up. It's going to be an Illinois statute, and it's a criminal code statute, and I'd have to look up these crimes. And when there's alcohol involved and there's aggravated issues like drugs and alcohol, I know the sentences get higher. Just for FYI, if you ever are in an accident like that, you need to stop. The law encourages you to do that. If you stop and you deal with it, it's much, much better than being caught when you hit and run. The law really hits you up and punishes you more for that, as it should. A lot of people, if they're intoxicated, as you know, Margaret, they will hit and run and they go and they hide out and they hope no one finds them, and therefore that no one will ever know that they're intoxicated. Let me do this. Can you email me? I'll give you the answer.
Well, I don't have a computer at home, but if you can bring that up and maybe have a lengthy discussion next week on your program, because I remember growing up when I was a little kid asking my dad, what does that mean, a hit and run? I remember my father saying to me, You know, when somebody does that, that's like committing murder. And to me, that's what it is, because if you are intoxicated or under influence of something, it's one thing if you stop and at least you're there to try to help the person or just to be there. But for somebody who takes off, that is murder. So please, if you can have somebody talk about that in detail, I think we would appreciate it.
Okay, Margaret, thank you. I'll see if I can get to that next week. And I just want to kind of clarify a little bit. The difference between accidentally hitting somebody and intending to hit somebody are two separate things. If I go and I'm driving down the road and someone happens to walk out and I can't stop in time and I unfortunately kill them, that is not necessarily murder. Okay, it might be reckless. It might be some crime, but it's probably not first degree intentional murder. And just because I leave the scene doesn't necessarily make that crime murder. Leaving the scene is a crime in and of itself. So I think we have to be careful now when you have alcohol issues or when you have drug issues and you go out recklessly and do this, then that heightens the crime and it makes it a more serious crime and one that can be punished more seriously. So just because you're leaving the scene, okay, doesn't make it a murder. First-degree murder. Again, I'm with you. People should not leave the scene of crime. Actually, I just had a caller from last week to contact me at the office, and unfortunately, she was in a hit-and-run, and her mother died. She was horribly injured, and they couldn't find the hit-and-run person. There was no way to blame anyone. The kid ran. He was probably high or intoxicated at the time, and no one was ever punished for it, which is just a horrible thing to have to live with, that your mother died because of this and you were injured because of something that someone did and doesn't stand to go to trial for it. But I hear you. I understand that. I got asked last week, I had a texter text me and asked me when can I videotape the police? And I've talked about this before, but I want to just talk about it again because I get this question all the time, that basically you can videotape the police. It used to be that there was a law in Illinois that said that you could not videotape the police. That went up to the Illinois Supreme Court, and it was deemed to be unconstitutional, and it was a violation of First Amendment rights. So yes, you can. Technically, you can't audio tape because that might be a wiretapping issue. But if you are in a situation and you're not obstructing the police doing his job or her job, you can do that. Now, that said, police do not like to have that done. And I have heard situations after this law was stricken down that police officers will get very angry and will try to take the phone away. And I've heard those stories. And listen, you don't want to get in trouble just to videotape something for, you know, for what benefit? Because if you struggle, you could be accused of resisting arrest or obstructing the investigation or obstructing the arrest or whatever's going on. So I would always weigh, you know, what your rights are versus what you should be doing. Policemen do a very difficult job. They are under a lot of stress, especially now with all of the crime and some of the attitudes in Chicago not being great for Chicago policemen. And be respectful when you do that. But you definitely have a legal right to do that. I had and also had a telephone call from Geraldine in Winnetka, a very lovely caller, and she told me that I could use this question. And she said that I'm involved in a divorce in DuPage County. She said on several occasions she was at court and she tried to say hello and have small talk with her husband's lawyer. And he completely ignores me. And my lawyer told me he cannot talk to him. What is the rule and why? That's a really good question. And as I told you in my conversation with you, when I am representing somebody and I'm representing, I'm suing somebody else, I can't talk directly to that person who's my opposing party if they are represented by counsel. So if I know that you have a lawyer and I'm suing you, I can't walk up and talk to you because that, you know, I have to deal with the lawyer. That's just a rule. It's in our ethical code. Yes, we do have ethical codes. And so the idea is that your the lawyer for your husband is not talking to you. It's not because he's being a jerk. It's, you know, it's not because he's being unfriendly. It's just he doesn't want to violate that rule. And, you know, technically he could probably say hello to you and that wouldn't be against the rule. But he's probably just being safe. And I think I would just smile at him and understand that he's just doing his job. So thank you for all your calls. Again, if you want to reach me at my office, it's WGN@AskKarenConti.com or 312-332-7800.